This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Mike O'Neill here with Mike Russell.
Yeah, we're going to talk. This is one of those days, Doc, where I figured I think maybe in my bag in my office, I think I have my SRP bill. I think I want to go grab that.
Mike and I, we're both major contributors to SRP, more than we would like. And we have just the folks to talk to. Paul Hurt and Nick Brown, both newly elected, probably have not assumed office yet, but will shortly. Right.
The election's been ratified, but we have not yet conceded for a meeting.
SRP directors. And let me get into that, and we'll go later, your background later. But I just want to basically get people to understand, because I know this is very poorly understood. Let me contrast SRP and APS. APS is a private corporation. Since it's a monopoly, it is regulated by the Arizona Corporation Commission, which we elect the commissioners, five of them. SRP is governed in a completely different way. And correct me if I have this wrong. SRP is essentially a government agency that is run by a board of directors onto which you have just been elected. Is that
correct?
Fair?
That's correct. It's a municipal corporation under the state of Arizona Constitution. It's really two things. The electric district, or more specifically, the agricultural improvement and electric district, is a public entity. So it's a subdivision of the state of Arizona. The SRP Water Association, by contrast, is a private organization.
I think one thing to add.
So water is private.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
And electric is a government.
Right.
It's a subdivision of the state of Arizona. Okay. That's correct.
Key thing to keep in mind is that it's a public power utility, meaning it's not for profit, as opposed to APS, which is a shareholder-owned for-profit corporation. That's why APS is regulated by the Corporation Commission so that they don't gouge customers, and SRP is not regulated because supposedly, since they're not for-profit, they are doing everything for the benefit of their ratepayers and customers,
now,
supposedly.
Of course, this nonprofit status, people are misinterpret that. You can make money.
Yeah.
Like, for example, our nonprofit hospitals. What you can't do is take that money and pay it out to stockholders.
Right.
You have to invest it in future. If you didn't make some money, you wouldn't be able to build new things that are necessary, for example, for growth.
Right.
And I know people who worked in hospitals have that. And then the old school people were resistant. You know, so I'm working for somebody in marketing in a hospital. And he said, we got to make money because we need to build this and this and this. Right. And the old charitable people said, we can't make money. We're a nonprofit. And they said, if we don't make money, we're out of business because we need new technology and things like that.
But you are a utility. And if I understand this correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong. If I understand correctly, utilities are protected by the Arizona State Constitution to, I believe, operate at some sort of a profitable margin, correct?
Am I
oversimplifying?
It's fine to have a carryover from year to year.
Okay.
So SRP's revenues on the electric side are something in the range of $3 billion a year. Over the last couple of years, in FY 14 and 15, there's been something in the range of about a $40 million surplus.
Okay.
So that's a carryover. That allows the institution some flexibility in all kinds of things, maintenance and operations and acquisitions, those kinds of things. The real money is in a bonding capacity, of course, in a way that's similar to municipalities. And as a municipal corporation, SRP has the same rights and immunities and privileges that municipalities do.
You can issue bonds.
That's correct.
And to build big stuff, basically. Yeah.
And to build small stuff.
And long-term stuff.
That's correct.
Yeah, I bought some of those years ago when interest rates were high. It was one of the best investments I ever made.
That's right.
And had it tucked away in my drawer so long, I forgot I owned it. I said, oh my God, this is 30 years. This has matured.
This is the best kind of bonds ever.
So now I want to get to the governance issue. I've got in front of me election sheet with the election results. And there's two kinds of people that are elected, really three. I see some of these listed. What's the difference between council and board?
Well, the board of directors makes most of the policy decisions. The council does the bylaws. They have meetings and make recommendations. They're part of the governance structure, but they don't have a whole lot of decision-making power.
So they're more advisory?
Yeah, more advisory. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And you're at large seat. There are a number of board members elected from districts, and you were both elected at large.
Right. So there's 10 districts that SRP has. They divide their service territory portion of their service territory into 10 districts. There's a lot in their service territory that's not eligible to vote in the election. So when they have their 10 districts, the 10 districts are just in eligible voting lands, which is only about a little more than half of the people that they serve are eligible to
vote. Okay, this is an important thing that not everybody will understand. In order to vote in this election, you must be a landowner, right?
A landowner in the defined territory that was set up in 1937.
Oh, okay. So I own a piece of property, and I'm not in that area, but it's an SRP territory. I pay an SRP bill. Right. I'm still not eligible to vote.
Exactly. Nobody in Ahwatukee can vote. Nobody in Queen Creek can vote. Nobody in Fountain Hills can vote. People in North Scottsdale and Phoenix can't vote. They're all served by SRP, but they're outside the 1937 boundary when they created the electric district.
There's one other quirk to this voting scheme that I think will blow most people's minds, is that I understand for at least some of these officers, so I own a piece of property. It's in the right geographical area. Mm-hmm. Which is a subset of the area that's served by of people that are paying bills to SRP. And as I understand it, the election is done on a one-acre, one-vote principle?
Right. That's back to the 10 districts. Mm-hmm. So there's one board of directors elected for each one of the 10 districts.
Then so that's 10. And then how many? And
then there's four at-large seats.
So the board is 14 people.
Exactly.
Four at-large, 10 in districts.
Right. Plus a president and a vice president for a total of 16.
Okay. And president and vice president are also elected by the people.
Exactly. And they're elected by acreage voting. So the 10 district elections and the president and vice president, it's 1 acre, one vote. So a farmer with 100 acres gets 100 votes, and a homeowner on a quarter acre gets a quarter of a vote. The four at-large seats are the only ones that are not acreage-based voting. You still have to be a landowner within the 1937 territory, but it's one property, one vote. And that's what Nick and I ran for and won, were two at-large seats, which are more democratically elected.
Uh-huh.
Now, the reason for this acre vote system is because in 1937, landowners, and at that point in time, mostly we were thinking about the agricultural community, put their land up as collateral to purchase from the federal government, from the Bureau of Reclamation, Roosevelt Dam and the canals that were coming to Phoenix. Because they put their land up for collateral,
Pay for the actual dam?
To pay for the actual dam. That's
so it
correct.
Wasn't federal money? It was paid for?
The feds initially built the dam, mm-hmm. and then subsequently the Water Association bought it back from the federal government.
Uh-huh. And landowners, mostly farmers at that time, pledged their land as collateral.
That's correct.
Is their land still on the hook?
Doc, hold on one second. Let's get back to that. Is their land still on the hook? We'll come right back to that. Oh, it's not. Okay, it's not. We have Paul Hurt and Nick Brown, newly elected SRP directors, with us right here in studio in the Think Tank. More next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back to how we elect these SRP board of directors. What I'm getting is, for 10 of the 14 seats, or 10 really of the 16 seats, or 12 really, the 12 at, 10 at large plus the two big officers, president and vice president, right? That is elected 1 acre, one vote. Now, how disparate is that? I mean, who's the biggest landowner? And what's the largest number of votes cast by an individual?
Well, one of our clean energy colleagues lost the election over in
District 3,
Division 3. And he lost that, we think, probably because of a single 200-acre vote.
Now, the opposing candidate won 370 votes, and he got 52.
That's 370-acre votes.
370-acre
votes.
Had that person the 200 acres voted differently, it would have been a different result.
Exactly. That's correct. Now, a lot of people don't like the optics of this. It doesn't sound very democratic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have tried to change it. There is some resistance because the agricultural community still has a strong influence on SRP and indeed on our community and water policy and those kinds of things.
Well, you say 1 acre, one vote, I'm going to think the person who controls that is going to be basically farmers, somebody who owns a bunch of acres. Now, if I understand correctly, you own a quarter of an acre. Do you get one vote, right?
Quarter of one vote.
Oh, you only get a quarter. It is right down to the fraction.
Correct.
I'd heard that you got one vote regardless. You don't.
That is correct. So I live in the McDowell corridor of Scottsdale. You'd need 1,400 Nick Browns to offset the value of this single individual.
By the way, let me also give people a notion of just understanding how few votes it actually takes. There's how many eligible voters in the
600,000
eligible
accounts. That is,
So and you're at large, 600,000 eligible voters, and to take Paul for example, you won by 1,576 to 1,470, and that was about 3,000 people voted out of the 160,000 eligible.
Right. And that was record voter turnout. They've never had that many
votes. And likewise, now, Nick, you won by a slightly larger margin. You got 1,604 votes to 1,422, 200-vote margin. Now, those are at large, so those are actual people voting.
Right.
And I look at some of these district-level things, however, and I see these people are being elected down with, a couple of hundred, 200, 300 votes, and those are acres.
Acre votes.
So that could be three or four people.
It could be.
Right? Well, in the one case, it was clearly the one person.
Right. And we think that there's little participation because people don't appreciate or understand that that it's their responsibility to vote in the same that you would any other local election because, in effect, the SRP Board of Directors is the regulatory body. You think that the SRP board is the counterpart to the Arizona Corporation Commission. If more people understood that, perhaps there would be more interest in voting.
There's also, you describe what you had to go through in order to vote. That wasn't made easy.
Well, you do have to request a ballot from the SRP corporate secretary. Now, having said that, you also have to register to vote in other elections, county and municipal elections.
Mm-hmm. But we know about that.
You know about that. That's correct. And it's a freestanding election. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you don't go to the poll and say, oh, my gosh, I think I'll cast a ballot for SRP directors as well. And because it's freestanding, that's just one more reason that people would not pay much attention to it.
I am guessing, and I think I'm fairly certain of this, that a very small proportion of the electorate is even aware of this. Were you aware of this?
I had no idea. No. I had absolutely no idea this was all going on.
I will say I've lived here 35 years. I voted in this election. That was the first one.
Yeah, we knocked on a lot of doors. Mm-hmm. So people ask us sometimes, how did you win? How did you do this? Because others have tried and failed. Uh-huh. And we pretty much said ground game. We had a ground game. We knocked on over 2,000 doors.
I don't think I'm opening it. I'm with SRP. No, I'm not answering the door.
Well, I want to move on to tell us who you are and why you ran.
There you go.
Well, this is Nick.
Yeah, and Nick, by the way, has better radio voice than both of us, and that's not. This is bad for our career.
Yeah. You're very kind. I have engaged in clean energy and environmental conservation really for my entire career. So, beginning in 1980, I was a solar coordinator in Bill Clinton's Arkansas Department of Energy, and since then, I've been managing and developing renewable energy projects throughout my career. So this is not something that I've just developed a recent affinity and interest in working on. I would have to say if there's one element, one occurrence that really spawned our interest in this, it was the E27 rate, which was the...
you got to explain that, you know.
Right. In February of 2015, the SRP Board of Directors passed new rates for new solar customers, and there's a demand charge, such that you are charged for your peak amount of demand for any 30-minute period over a month, in addition to energy charges.
Explain that to me, a 30-minute period, because I heard demand as being the highest amount you hit, but I said, oh, if I flip some switch, you're not going to get dinged up, but you have to run it 30 minutes sustained before it counts.
It's a 30-minute average.
Okay, the average, the highest average over a 30-minute
period. That's correct.
So if I'm peaking out for 2 minutes, that only hurts me proportional.
Well, your air conditioner comes off and on.
Right.
Your pool pump may come off and on. A lot of your
But it's not about the absolute spike for 30 seconds. I got everything in the world running, and then I flip the switch.
It is not an instantaneous reading. Okay. That's right. So it's 30-minute average reading. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with this seems to be that the demand rates were very, very high. Mm-hmm. Number one. Number two, when demand rates come to residential accounts, and by the way, I think they'll come to all accounts, not just solar accounts in the coming
months.
But
this is being applied to solar.
Only to new solar customers.
And not to non-solar customers.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, when a utility charges a demand rate, then there's a responsibility that goes along with the right to do that. And that responsibility is to help the ratepayer manage their peak. And so that can be done by smart grid, which connects your thermostat with the utility, and they have some ability to manage that, or perhaps your water heater, those kinds of things. So we need new technologies and implementation of those in combination with demand charges. And so that hasn't happened. Consequently, the rates for new solar customers are much, much, much higher, between $50 and $100 a month higher than previous.
All right, Doc, I found my bill, so it's okay. We're going to go over the break. We're going to go over my bill line by line with the new guys over there at SRP, Paul Hurt and Nick Brown, the newly elected SRP directors. This is absolutely fascinating. I had no clue any of this was going on. I thought they were just kicking on a switch and turning it off at night. We'll get more right here in the Think Tank next.
I know that lives are at stake. Yours and mine and our descendants of time.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with Paul Hurt and Nick Brown, newly elected board of directors for SRP. And we were talking about solar, and we probably lost some audience there on demand charge, because most of us were used to, we pay for how much juice we use. Now, demand charge, as I understand it, tell me if I get it wrong, essentially charges you, in addition to that, it charges you for kind of your peak uses. If you hit, and usually, you know, in the summer in Arizona, that's going to be somewhere between, about 3 or 4 in the afternoon and about 9 at night, something like that. And there is a rationale to that, I think you'd agree, that it costs the utility more to produce
demand.
Peak power, because you gotta put on extra kind of stuff, and sometimes that's more expensive to do. That at other times you got your hydroelectric going and that pays for everything. You gotta fire up some other plants to pay for that, and so you want to keep that down. That's legit.
Right. Yeah.
But what I'm hearing here is this peak charge is being thrown at new solar customers and not traditional customers, and the logic of that somehow defies me.
Right. Just charging only solar customers, this peak charge is not going to solve their problem of having to provide too much peak demand.
Isn't solar producing power more at the times when you want it? I mean,
during the first half of peak demand, there's still solar energy being
generated. 3 to 6 or exactly. 7 or something like
after
that.
After that,
not solar
so much.
Is a plus in there.
Exactly.
Because it's taking the load off. Maybe it's 7 or 8 or something like that. It's still peak demand. But
yeah. It's important to realize only 0.6% of SRP's power is coming from solar. So
From rooftop solar.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when they start, but if you start lopping on charges like that, it seems to me what that's going to do is inhibit the growth of
exactly.
solar.
Exactly. So what the E27 rate plan did is it shut down the advance of solar energy in SRP service territory. Mm-hmm. There was a 97% decline in applications for rooftop solar the month after they put this plan into place.
97%. In other words, it basically went to near zero.
Shut it down. We also lost, there was a solar jobs report published about a month ago. We lost 2,200 jobs in the solar industry in Arizona in 2015. And most of the reason for that is the collapse of the rooftop solar market in SRP service territory.
Okay, wait, well, hold on. From the outside, though, from the outsider's perspective, from my perspective, that looks like, okay, SRP just shut this down. SRP saw, whoa, people are going to have their own energy. We can have none of that. We will shut this down in any way we can. How far off am I on that? I'm not asking to throw your new company under the bus here, but I mean, hey, it kind of looks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Yeah. Well, we can't speak for anybody else over there in SRP.
Sure.
This is why we ran for the board of directors, okay, because of the outcome of that E27 rate plan. They did want to slow it down significantly. I'm not sure they expected it to drop by 97%. I don't think they expected 2,200 jobs to be lost. I suspect that they're going to be interested in maybe revisiting this issue as a result. But they very clearly designed the rate plan to put the brakes, significantly put the brakes on the advance of rooftop solar energy. And they accomplished that to an exceptional degree.
Why do you think they did it?
Wow. Well, that's the national debate that we're having right now over traditional utility business model versus the rapid increase in renewable energy, not just solar, but wind and biomass. There's new ways of generating power in a distributed manner and for homeowners to generate power at a rate competitive with the kind of power that they're paying for from their electric utility.
Maybe not if you're slapping on those kinds of fees, though.
Exactly.
Sure.
So there's new competition for the old business model. I mean, the old traditional utilities that had large centralized power plants, mainly fired by fossil fuels, coal in particular, but also nuclear and natural gas, that's the old model, which is we build a gigantic capital-intensive plant, we produce a tremendous amount of electricity, we send it out on transmission lines, and we sell it. We produce it, they buy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the old model that's been around for 100 years and has been, you know, pretty stable and reliable.
And back in the beginning, in fairness, it was the only way to do it.
Exactly. I mean, it was the only feasible, technologically and economically feasible way to do it. We've had solar power since the 1950s. It's just been too expensive. In the last 5 years, the cost of solar and wind has dropped so much that it's now cost competitive for the first time with fossil fuel generated electricity.
Hmm.
So suddenly, there's a new player on the market. There's a new competitor. And companies like SolarCity have jumped into that and are doing great business developing distributed renewable energy generation.
So,
and the utilities are getting scared. They're afraid to embrace this new reality. They're resistant to developing a new business model that will work in this new reality. Some utilities are embracing it. Some are trying to figure out what they need to do to change to be successful and profitable and reliable in the future. But some are simply scared and are trying to, you know, hold off the changes that are coming, whether they like it or not.
I wouldn't say as scared as we are, because we as consumers, we think change equals hold on to your wallet. That's what this is sounding like to us, because we've heard for years, and we discussed this at the break, is that you save water. Say, you know, lower utility bill. You want lower bills? Save water. You want lower electricity bills? Turn off your lights. This and that. So we do that. And we live in caves. It's dark. It's dungeonous, right? And then our bills start to drop. And then the utility companies say, wait, we're not making as much money. We need to go to the Corporation Commission. We need to ask them for a rate increase. And then, boom, we're still living in dungeons and paying the same that we were when we had every light on in the house. What the heck?
There are a couple of things that I'd point out. First, to go back to the question of motive, I'm not convinced that there's a motive to kill solar energy or to even slow it down. I will say that it's very complex and difficult problem to determine what the real value, the costs, and the benefits of installing hundreds or thousands of rooftop solar energy systems into the grid might be. So there's a very big contentious dialogue about what solar customers really ought to be paying when they have access to the grid but actually purchase no energy. That's something that honest people will disagree about and do disagree about.
And most solar users need access to the grid, because if we have a bunch of dark days or you want to, most don't have the ability to store, so you need some power at night.
Well, let's just say all, because I think at this point in time that's the case. Now to your point about revenue for the utilities. In fact, they do sell less energy as we conserve more. There are a couple of things about this. One is that the less energy they sell during peak times, most of the peak power plants, peakers they're called, are brown energy plants, and they're older. That's the reason they're not baseload plants, or they're not running all the time. They're more expensive to operate than the baseload plants. So, in effect, for the moment, as we conserve and deploy efficiency, the utility sells less, but what they're selling less of is energy that it costs them more to generate to start with. That's point one.
More costly and dirtier.
That's correct. Yes. Both. That's right. Now, secondly, I'll say that it is, in fact, important for utilities to be creative, perhaps be a little riskier than utilities have traditionally been, but certainly to evaluate and deploy new technologies and new means for revenue generation. So, for example, thermal energy. Downtown NRG, which is a private energy company, is making money selling steam and chilled water to the towers downtown in a district energy system. That's something that utilities can look at and perhaps should do in places where towers are aggregated and there are big commercial centers. Mm-hmm. We will sell more electricity as electric cars need more electricity. And so for us to engage in partnerships to expand the EV car market is going to be a really good thing. And that's an opportunity for expanded revenue in the face of contracting revenue in some other ways.
I got one sort of big question I've been dying to ask, and I saved it for the end. You are clearly cut from a different cloth of folk from most of the folks who've been on the board. You're two guys out of a board of 16 members. How do you expect to have influence?
Well, I think the first thing I want to do certainly is learn how to be a competent board director. It's not not de facto given that's what I'm going to be day one or month one or even year one. So there's a lot to learn about what the priorities are and what they should be, and how to wade through the complex issues of utility regulation. Second, I think, and related to that, is developing working relationships that are uniformly positive with management and with the existing board. We want to do that, and yes, we think a little bit differently, but so do all kinds of folks who end up collaborating very effectively, and so that's the second thing we'll do. And then thirdly, I think we will want to be very careful to propose projects and programs that have a really good sound financial basis, both for ratepayers and for management. You know, there's a tension between the well-being of the institution, the corporation, and the well-being of the ratepayers. Mm-hmm. And so we have to keep that balance in the same way that other regulators do, the ACC and mm-hmm. others.
But there's that fundamental difference in that you're not attempting to maximize profit as APS does, constrained by the ACC, but you are to serve your customers.
Well, that's exactly right. And the corollary to that is that we're also serving the customers of future generations. So we can afford to internalize some costs, and I'm talking about environmental costs and social costs, that shareholder corporations don't pay much attention to sometimes.
Because they answer to their stockholders.
That's correct.
Who want a bigger dividend next quarter.
Now, Paul, you want to weigh in here?
Well, SRP did a survey of their customers to find out their interests and values on a variety of topics. And it turns out that between 70 and 80% of their customers want to see more solar energy and clean energy development than we currently have. So serving their customer base, sometimes they say, well, you know, there's only a tiny number of people with rooftop solar, and they're just a small, you know, amount of our constituents. But it turns out that the vast majority, 3/4 of their constituents, would like to see them embrace clean, renewable energy more aggressively than they have.
Hear, hear. All right. Paul Hurt, Nick Brown, newly elected SRP directors. Thank you, and good luck in your new positions. And please report back to us as you dig in, get more into the meat and potatoes. We'd love to have you back and keep us all posted on it. Inform us, too, as to what's going on at SRP. Thank you very much. Doc and I are going to tie a big fat bow around this one next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Well, that was enlightening. Holy mackerel. Man, that's two newly elected SRP directors. I just went to school right there. That was pretty fascinating. If you've missed part of that, by the way, if you missed the first half of the show, I highly recommend going back and checking out the podcast because we got a lesson into the difference between SRP and APS. Wow.
Which most people don't know.
And I didn't get to the one question.
Even though they do exactly the same thing, their structures, APS is a private corporation.
Yeah.
And because it's a monopoly, that corporation is regulated by the Corporation Commission, which has no regulatory authority over SRP because SRP is a government agency that's elected by vote of the people, but only 1% of the people vote in that election.
Okay. Got it. So this is the one question I didn't get to, which it really bumps me out because I really wanted to get to it. Why, if you're a monopoly, when they are, they both are, by the way, you don't have a choice.
A utility is what they call a natural monopoly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Why do you advertise? Why do you waste money and advertise and then run my rates up? I know they're not a one-to-one, but still, if you're going to look through a profit and loss statement at the end of the year, there's a big chunk that went to advertising and sponsoring stadiums and all of this noise, and still you're raising my rates. That drives me batty.
Well, I can make the case stronger for APS as to why they would do it. APS, as a regulated industry, is interested in maintaining a positive perspective in terms of the public, and they essentially want the public to think well of them.
I don't know anyone who goes, I love my utility company. You know, as a matter of fact, I love writing that $300 check in August. No one likes that.
But they're out. You'll see if you run community organizations, APS in particular, SRP, I think to a lesser extent, does sponsorships and things like that. Your point's a fair one.
Yeah.
You're going to buy the product anyway.
You have to. You have a choice.
But whether or not you like the entity they're trying to shake up. Now, some of the advertising is good. For example, as we discussed here, the cost of delivering power depends on what time of day you deliver it.
Absolutely.
I mean, they got some hydroelectric going and say at 10 in the morning. That covers most or all of their cost, and it really doesn't cost them much of anything extra if you turn on the power. When you get to the peak periods, they've got to crank up the coal plants and the oil plants, and that costs them a lot. And so to advertise to people to tamp down the use during then and to advertise that they have plans that do that. They have time of day plans.
Sure.
And they will basically charge you more in the peak periods and give you really cheap rates in the off periods.
And we get that. By the way,
they also advertise to educate people about that.
Okay. I understand outreach, but sponsoring stadiums and the bags at these different rates is just a bunch of silliness to me anyway. I want to take their side for a second here, the actual utility side. And I'll actually take the gas companies as well. I'll take the fuel companies as well. Think about this. I'm talking about just gas in your car, okay? We take a dinosaur bone from the ground and turn it into fuel that runs your car, okay? Mm-hmm. Just simplifying it, super simply. And usually that's done somewhere in the Middle East and then is brought over here on tanker trucks, this and that. That gallon costs about the same as a gallon of milk that was taken from a cow down the road, by the way. Fascinating to me that people complain that gas prices are over $2 because they're not understanding what they're getting. And the reason why I bring that up is because these guys at SRP and APS making electricity an easy. This isn't easy. They have these giant plants, and like he said the overhead heavy, or I forget the exact term he used.
Well, they're
these
big plants. Capital intensive.
Yeah,
it costs you millions and millions of dollars
to
build a big plant, and I think that's the reason why they got into this mindset, frankly, about solar. They have this massive investment, and they don't want, if everybody went 100% solar, they'd have a problem. They'd have this plant that was useless.
Absolutely.
The thing is, that's not going to happen.
SRP insured it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, but all solar, where it could save money for everybody, including the utility, is if it takes the edge off, it keeps them from having to build that next plant. Nobody's going to build so much solar that the existing plant is going to be underutilized. Mm-hmm. But that next $300 million plant that they might not have to build if we get pervasive solar is a win-win for everybody, particularly for an SRP, not an APS. See, APS is a private company interest. They want to sell as much power as they can at the highest rate that the ACC will allow them to do, and they make money for their stockholders. That's not the mandate of SRP. The mandate of SRP is to meet the needs of its customers. That means water for the farmers. That means electricity for everybody at the most reasonable rate that they could, because there's no stockholders going to get that.
But
so if you can be prevented from having to build that next monster plant because of increasing use for demand as the valley grows, it can be a win-win for everybody.
Okay, but when you say this, it's a lot like we had our Board of Regents in here, and we're talking about the colleges, and we're talking about price of tuition, and they said we need to, the Constitution of Arizona says that tuition should be
as nearly free as possible.
As nearly free as possible. Now, how relative is that? So when we talk about they need to offer it at a rate that is as cheap as they can, but they're having a $40 million carryover from the year prior. It just seems like it is what it is. It's a monopoly, and it doesn't matter.
I don't know whether that's too much or not enough, but because that's a very detailed question. Because I don't want them to run out of money because we're in deep trouble, right?
Sure.
I want them to be able to build for the future. But in point of fact, if we have increasing demand over time, and on solar is not going to like jump overnight and take over their whole business.
It's an expensive thing to do.
If it grows, it may cut the need for that reserve to build that next plant.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
And by the way, I'm convinced ultimately, these guys will have some influence because I think as they pointed out, I think the board had no idea that they were going to drive solar to a complete dead stop.
Right,
and they may rethink this. And these are very educated, thoughtful folks, and
they know this.
And if they go in there and they just do it by vote, they're going to lose. They're going to have to persuade people.
And like you said, this wasn't something he just got interested in. He was with the Clinton administration out in Arkansas.
Yeah, they're substantive matter experts.
Absolutely,
hopefully folks on a board start listening to expertise. They'll get a seat at the table. It'll be interesting to see how it goes.
I'm not holding my breath. It's a utility.
It's a long-term deal.
Yes, it is. All right, go ahead with your pitch.
The pitch, MikeO'Neill.org. You can listen to blogs, writings, and other things. Also, archive of all our old
shows. You read the blogs.
Whatever that is. But all the shows are on there and other writings and everything you need to know.
A few of Mike O'Neill's musings.
Musings.
Maybe some music like this.
There's a little musical note at the bottom of the page. You click on that, you can download your own copy of this music.
How about that? By Doc O'Neill himself. Or you can get over to KTIR.com and check out the Think Tank show page. Yes, you can find it. It is easy, I promise you. Thanks for spending some time with us right here on the Think Tank.